Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this week is Pip Hare, the British solo sailor who set the social media world alight during her single-handed circumnavigation of the world in the last Vendée Globe. Pip was sailing on one of the oldest and least technologically advanced boats in the fleet and faced a raft of issues along the way, but she made it around and finished in 19th place. The first British skipper home. As you'll hear in the interview, Pip had to overcome plenty of hurdles just to get to the start line. The COVID pandemic didn't help, and financially it was touch and go for quite a while. But just as she was beginning to doubt whether she would make it, an email from a prospective sponsor changed everything. Pip Hare, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. We've never met, but I strangely feel like I somehow know you, having avidly followed your progress around the world on your adventure in the Vendée Globe. So it's a real thrill to have you as a guest on the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So where are we talking to you from today, Pip?
So I am at home in a very blustery pool as, can't remember what the name of the storm is. Dudley, is it? Dudley's approaching us.
Oh, wow. So it's not a day for sailing then today?
No, definitely not. I went out for a run this morning and got blown along the beach, but that's about it.
Now, Pip, we're definitely, of course, going to talk lots about the Vendée Globe, but I first wanted to just get a feel for how this love affair you've obviously had with sailing from a very early age, how that came about. Can you shine some light on that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a landlocked county. Not a lot of sailing went on. I actually grew up in Cambridgeshire. And we sort of had access to Grafham Water. That was the closest place that people went sailing. And I did bits and pieces, but kind of never really took to it. And I think my love affair, I suppose, started when I started river sailing. So my grandfather sailed a folk boat on the River Deben in Suffolk, and we used to go out and sail with him. And then it was all really adventurous. It was swallows and Amazons, jumping off the boat, making rope swings, that sort of thing. And then I started sailing down in the West Country when I was a teenager. And I think that really was when I experience the freedom that sailing can give you. And especially as a teenager, it's a very powerful thing, because teenagers, you know, desperate to make decisions on their own, desperate to have responsibility, but they're just not allowed to. And yet you stick a teenager on the helm of a boat, they can make so many decisions. And I found that freedom exhilarating, and then quickly equated that to travel and seeing the world and adventure, and that was it, really. That was all I wanted to do.
Yeah, I think the freedom of sailing when you're a teenager is familiar to a lot of people listening to the podcast. Did you come, though, from a sailing family? You said your grandfather or your uncle had a boat.
Yeah, so my grandfather had a folk boat, which he actually used to race. So he was the racer in the family. And then my dad and my mum sailed, but they were serious cruisers. So they had, when we were kids, they had a Moody 33 that we used to go cruising on. There were normally eight of us rammed into it. It was very sort of waddly, slow cruising. So, yeah, I did come from a sailing family, but no racing.
And did sailing have to compete with any other sports in your life at that stage as a teenager?
Yeah, so, I mean, when I was a teenager, the sailing was the hard thing to do. And I used to work. I worked really hard. I worked at the weekends. I worked before school. I worked after school. And that was basically so I could save up train fares to go to the coast and take part in sailing. And that way, then I got my sailing miles through volunteering for charities. mostly charities that were providing sailing opportunities for physically disabled people. And we're always looking for able-bodied volunteers. And so all I had to do was find the train fare and I could go and do that. I mean, I did enjoy other sports at school, lots of team sports, but I was never really seriously into anything.
Tell me more about the volunteer sailing, because I wasn't really aware of that, that aspect of your history.
I think I got offered so I started sailing with the Seamanship Foundation, which was kind of the part of the RYA that preceded Sailability. And the Seamanship Foundation offered sailing for young people. It was courses for young people by young people. And it also provided sailing opportunities for disabled people. And so through my young people's courses, I then got offered opportunities to volunteer on other sailing expeditions. And it really worked out. You know, it added up in my head for me. I desperately wanted to go sailing and these people really wanted volunteers. And so I got to go sailing some amazing boats. I got to meet people, learn from them. And really my first steps into offshore sailing were all through that medium of volunteering on bigger boats as part of sailing programs. And I think it's, as a way of getting into sailing, I think it's quite underrated by an awful lot of people. They don't realise how much they can get out of it by doing it.
And those schemes still exist today, is that's right?
That's right, yeah. So I have, over the years, I've volunteered for the Jubilee Sailing Trust, which of course has Tenacious, the square rigger, and the London Sailing Project. Who else have I... Yeah, I mean, most of them still exist. Yeah, yeah.
So you're really the poster girl for this approach, aren't you?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I know plenty of people who have done similar things to me. It's surprising when you start talking to people, you know, how many of them have volunteered on all of these incredible, because the boats are quite old, you know, they're really well-built, old, sturdy boats. So you meet an awful lot of people along the way who have volunteered. But I don't think anybody's ended up where I did.
No. So how did that... I mean, I'm guessing a lot of this wasn't involving any kind of racing, but it was valuable sea miles and experience and time on the water. But how did it transition into the racing side of it?
I mean, I desperately wanted to race. I was always, you know, looking. When I would go down the Hamble River on, you know, Rona or something like that, one of the London Sailing Project boats, I would kind of look out at all of those boats, all those race boats. And on a Sunday, I'd see all the guys getting on board and going racing. And I desperately wanted to do that. I read loads of books about the Whitbread. But I had no idea how on earth to get a foot in the door. I'd never sailed in a club that did any racing, and also I was a very shy person, and there was no way on earth I ever would have dared walk up to a crew full of men and say, can I come racing with you please? And so I kind of stuck to the cruising. I became a sailing instructor. So went through all of the RYA courses then as well. And I guess I just kind of built up all of that offshore experience from the outside looking in. And it wasn't really until my mid to late 20s that I got involved in racing. And that was through a sailing school that actually taught racing. So I went and worked as an instructor for them, a yacht master instructor. And that gave me opportunities to get into racing at the same time.
I read on your website that you first learnt about the Vendée Globe and first started dreaming about the Vendée Globe when you were a teenager. Did it seem like an unattainable dream?
I mean, it did and it didn't, because, you know, if I think about actually the first time that, you know, I opened a magazine and read about it, I think I read about the BOC Challenge first and then the Vendée Globe. And I remember really distinctly, I was at my school in Huntingdon, in the middle of Cambridgeshire, you know, getting ready to do my A-levels and reading about this thing that just seemed so incredible, such an amazingly difficult race. And I guess it did seem a long way away from the life that I was living then, but there must have been something about it that seemed attainable, because in that moment, I kind of said to myself, that's what I want to do.
Have there been moments along the way that you've thought, yeah, but I'm never going to make it? Or has that always, have you always fostered that belief that you could get to do the race?
I think I always believed that if I had the opportunity, I would be successful in the race. I always believed that I had the qualities that you needed to get around the world. But creating that opportunity to take part in the race is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And I doubt I will ever do anything harder. And there were many, many, many knockbacks along the way. You know, many, many people telling you didn't have the right background, you didn't come from the right place, you know, you were too old, you were too young. Just, you know, and there are a couple of times where I did kind of just say, okay, I'm going to stop banging my head against the wall now, because this is not happening. And I don't think I can make it happen. But then you park it for a couple of years, and there is just this kind of ball of fire inside you just burning away, and it doesn't go away. And I always had to go back and just try again. Okay, well, I'll try one more time. I'll try doing this. The next step is this. So yeah, it was something I couldn't let go of.
It's kind of a familiar story, isn't it? I'm sure there's a whole bunch of French skippers who've had similar experiences to you along the way. And I just think about reading Pete Goss's book where, you know, he suffered from exactly the same problem. Do you think it was harder because you're a woman?
I think that initially getting the experience was a lot harder. I know it was. Because I saw people, you know, the same as me, get invited onto those boats to go sailing, get those opportunities. You know, and when I started out as a professional sailor when I was 18 in 1992, you know, there were, I don't know, participation in offshore sailing then by women was probably less than 2%. You know, I was constantly questioned about what I was doing there, you know, what my ability was. Did I really know what I was doing? So, you know, finding that confidence, finding those opportunities to build experience has been very, very hard. But I think the final push, you know, turning that experience that I'd gained into a Vendée Globe, I think that is as difficult for anyone, doesn't matter, because, you know, trying to find the funding and make it happen is a really, really hard thing.
Yeah. Well, we'll come on, we'll talk a lot more about the Vendée in a sec. You mentioned earlier as a teenager the sense of freedom that sailing gave you. All these years later, you're still clearly addicted to the sport. What do you get from sailing these days?
Oh, I think it is the same. I think it is the same feeling. You know, I've often said that sailing allows me to be the best version of me. Particularly when I'm solo sailing, I can be someone that I can't be on the land, because there are no boundaries. I can push myself. I can problem solve. I'm forced into doing things that on the land there's always an easy option you can always bail out of. But also, you know, I love the fact that as a sailor, you never know it all. There's always room to improve, room to learn. You know, there's always going to be a situation, a circumstance that you haven't seen before. And in the longer sailing races, you know, I love the never-ending opportunity to do better. You do something wrong, you can pick yourself up, you can learn from it. And other people are having similar circumstances. So there's always an opportunity to fight back, to come back. It's like everything is reset all the time. And it just makes me unbelievably ecstatically happy.
Well, that's a good enough reason in itself to do it, yeah. So I'm always intrigued, though, with professional sailors. You know, they've all sailed since they were, most of them anyway, have sailed since they were teenagers. And I always like to ask them, do you still enjoy it now, you know? So it's good to hear that you are still getting that much pleasure out of it. So listen, let's draw a line then between you working as a sailing instructor. You started to do some racing, you're doing some offshore racing. Draw the line for me through to the Austar race, Plymouth to Newport, which you did, I think, about 10 years ago. That seems to be a huge step up from where you were.
Yeah, that I did that in 2009. And that was just, I think, deciding to enter that race was really the moment that I really seriously said, I am going to throw everything I have at getting to that start of the Vendée. And it happened because I was living on a boat at the time, cruising it double-handed. I'd done so many miles. By then I had done hundreds of thousands of miles, both crewed and double-handed, nothing ever solo. But I was just racking up all of this experience. And I think my double-handed experience made me realize that I could, you know, I could be able to handle a boat solo. And I'd been very much focused on the Mini Transat because, you know, all of the sailors that went before me, they either kind of came from the BT Challenge route or the Clipper route, or they did minis like Ellen. And so I was kind of looking for this way in. I knew I didn't want to do something like the Clipper, but I also knew that the chances of getting a sponsorship on the back of that were still quite remote. So I kept thinking, okay, I need to do a Mini Transat, but then, you know, you need a boat, you need the sponsorship, and it just seemed so hard. And then all of a sudden I just realized, okay, well, there are other solo races out there and I have a boat. So I'm the only person that's stopping me. I can make this happen. I can create my own opportunity and it might look different to everyone else, but I can do this. And so I'd been doing a lot of corporate sailing then as you know, the Solent was full of boats doing corporate sailing then. It sort of was the heyday of it. And I spoke to a company, Cazenove Capital, who I'd been skippering for years. And I actually said to them, I want to do this. And they said, okay, well, if you get back, we'll sponsor you. And at the time, my boat was in Uruguay. I'd never sailed solo overnight before. So I packed up all my stuff, set sail on like the 3rd of January, I think it was. And I sailed 7,500 miles from Uruguay to the UK just to see if I could.
Solo?
Yeah.
So, that's longer than the race itself, isn't it?
Yeah, that was my qualification. But it was worth doing because I think I'd been hankering after this for so long. You know, it had been such a long-term dream. And actually, I thought I was really sure I could do it, but I didn't know. And I'm not a massively confident person. And I need to prove to myself I can do something before I go out and prove to other people I can do it. So actually doing that first solo crossing when I had no pressure, that was where I learned how to do polyphasic sleeping. That was how I climbed the mast for the first time ever then on my own. You know, I learned about really being alone because I had no satcoms. I had no way of contacting anyone. I didn't actually utter a sound out of my mouth for 2 weeks. So without going straight into the stress of a race the first time that I was solo, I just kind of learned all of these things, made all of those mistakes. And then the next time I went out, it was with the mentality of, okay, I know I can cross an ocean on my own. Can I race across an ocean on my own? Can I push the limits? Can I tread that line of risk and reward? You know, how hard can I push this boat? And so I had a huge confidence going into the race.
That's fantastic. And tell us about the boat that you were that you did this mammoth delivery trip on, and then this kind of fairly short hop across as the race.
That boat, few loves of my life, actually. They're all boats. It was a Lightwave 395, an Oyster Lightwave 395. It was called the Shed, lovingly called the Shed. And yeah, I lived on it for quite a few years, sailed many, many, many miles on it. And I did the Austar on it in 2010. And then won IRC overall in the double-handed Round Britain and Ireland race Austar 2009, Round Britain and Ireland 2010. I was very sad to sell it, but the new owner still loves it, I know, because every time I see him, he tells me.
Oh, you still see the boat as well. That's interesting. It was called the Shed. Where did that name come from?
Just because it was a total and utter wreck when we bought it. And we just called it the Shed because we thought everyone else would look at it and say it was a shed. So.
All right. So you on that transatlantic trip from Uruguay, you kind of discovered that you could do it. Did you discover that you liked it being solo sailing?
I did. Yeah, I did. The first 2 weeks were really scary, really, really scary. Lots of doubts, lots of emotion. The learning to sleep thing was, it is like being tortured. You know, you just have to break the back of it. It was enormously difficult. Climbing the mast was pivotal. It was terrifying, but it was kind of one of those moments where I just had to say to myself, okay, if you're serious about this, if you must do this, if not, just turn around, give up. That's it. I really did enjoy it. And I was very much looking forward to the Austar kind of by the time I'd made it back to the UK. Yeah.
So what was the gap between the delivery trip and the Austar?
Oh, it was pretty fast. I think I got back to the UK. Yeah. So I was the trip back to the UK took me 65 days. I think, 65 days, because I'd planned just to go straight through the Azores High and motor through the Azores High. But the output shaft coupling on my engine stripped. It evidently had been going for a while and it completely went. So I had no propulsion at all. So I sailed every single mile and the sails were actually falling apart because they were quite old. So I would kind of have to get up in the morning, survey the sails, and then find seams where all the stitching had gone. And I'd drop them down and have to sew them back together again and then hoist them up. And I blew up my big spinnaker, so I only had a little one. So it did take a while to get back. I got back at the end of February, and the Austar started on the 25th of May, and we had to do a total refit to the boat. So I had new sails, I replaced the standing rigging, there was some damage to a bulkhead, the boat was just kind of out of the water, gutted, stripped. I did all the work myself, and it was quite funny because I met some of the other Austar competitors beforehand and they were all there kind of just polishing their boats and I was there covered in fiberglass and with masts down and so it wasn't very long.
Yeah, wow, what a kind of baptism of fire. And did you find that, you know, now you have a sponsor who's paying for a lot of this refit and the new sails, did that change things for you mentally? Was there a bit of more pressure on?
It did. And actually, you know, the fact that somebody had invested in me, you know, I took that really seriously. And you know, in real terms, when I look back at it, it was a pretty small investment, but to me it was absolutely enormous. And I did feel a huge amount of responsibility for it. And actually what happened on that Austar was I broke a lower about 3 days into the race. I broke a lower, and I'd actually been leading the race on IRC then. And we went through some pretty bad weather. I broke a rib, and then one of my lowers went.
You broke one of your own ribs.
I broke one of my ribs and,
oh, wow.
and the lower on the boat. And they'd only just changed the rules for the Austar then. So previously, basically, if you hit the land, you're out. But they changed the rules that year and said you could go in and make a repair and restart. And so I turned around and went into Baltimore, and my dad and a friend came out with a spare lower, and I replaced them in Baltimore. But one of the guys from my sponsors said they'll always remember this email that I sent them from the boat that was, they said was heartrending, because I basically just kind of sent, after I broke the lower, I just sent this email out to everyone who'd helped me just saying, I've let you all down. I'm so sorry. I don't know what I could have done differently. You all trusted me and I let you down. I was literally just ripping myself to pieces. But then after that, I restarted, and I can't remember all the details, but I think I was about 500 miles behind the leaders. It was a long way behind, but I just thought, okay, well, I'm going to race. I'm just going to see how far I can catch up. And I'm going to compare my speeds all the time. I'm going to compare my speeds with the guys at the front. And I know we're in different weather systems, but I'm just going to do that. And I did. I raced my socks off and ended up overtaking about half the fleet and finishing 19th. And with a time that would have put me in the top three. But I drew little pictures on the inside of my cuddy of each of the boats, the next one to overtake. And I kind of drew a picture and wrote their name under it and then crossed it out when I overtook them. And it kind of went through the fleet, and everyone was really terrified of having a picture of their boat on the inside of my cuddy, because it's like, I'm coming for you.
Yeah, you're like a World War One fighter pilot, yeah. So do you think that experience... I mean, you could have gone on and won the race if you hadn't had the damage, but the experience of kind of having to write that email, having to experience that kind of crushing disappointment, did that set you up maybe better for what was ahead of you?
I think all of these things do. And one thing that I think I realized immediately, because I never for one second imagined that I would quit. You know, I would always fix that boat and carry on. And that I have done that in every single race, every single issue like that I've come across. I just like, right, I'm just going to fix it. And then I'm going to make the most of what I've got now. And I think, you know, I wasn't necessarily aware that I had that mentality, but it really came out in that event. And I think it's definitely kind of, I guess it's the template for everything that's gone afterwards. That is the benchmark. You never give up. You just take whatever you're dealt, deal with it, and then just fight your way out of it.
Fantastic. Before we move on with the kind of timeline there, I wanted to ask you where the journalism came in, because you're possibly more famous as a journalist than you are as a skipper, although maybe not now after the Vendée. But I mean, I certainly knew your name for a long time, but as a journalist who kind of wrote how-to pieces and did how-to videos and, you know, was certainly the expert on offshore sailing. Where did that all begin?
I used to enjoy writing when I was at school. And I think, you know, it was one of the things that I thought I might have wanted to do in my adult life when I was a schoolgirl, but it kind of went by the wayside. But I've always enjoyed writing. And because I don't come from, you know, because I come from a place where sailing is not a familiar thing, none of my school friends understood. I left school and went sailing. They all went to university or went traveling, or but none of them really understood what I was doing. But that was back in the day when, you know, we used to communicate with aerograms and, you know, no emails, fax if you were lucky. but I used to, especially when I started traveling with my sailing, I used to write to my friends about what I was doing and try to really kind of paint them a picture so that they would understand what I was doing. And so I've always loved writing about sailing in that way. And I've always loved teaching. And in 2000, I think it was about 2008, I'd been writing just for myself, and someone said to me, why don't you send that to a magazine? And I was just like, no, why would I do that? And then I thought, well, maybe I should. And I emailed a piece to Yachting World, to Elaine Bunting at Yachting World, and was really surprised because she came back to me and said, I really like this, but we can't publish it because we've got something really similar in the magazine. But that kind of gave me a confidence that my writing was okay. And then when I did the Austar in 2009, I got in contact with her again and I told her what I was doing. I said, look, I'm sailing back from Uruguay. I've never sailed solo before. I'm doing the Austar. Are you interested? And she suggested that I did a column, and that kickstarted it all off, really. I've been writing ever since.
Fantastic. Well, it's better for all of us that you do that. And I guess you'll continue to do that. Do you have time still to write?
Yeah, I'm really keen. I mean, I do less now, and I think I am a total pain for my editors, but I want to carry on writing, just as I'm still involved as much as I can with the kind of RYA teaching scheme. I'm still a Yacht Master Examiner. I'm a cruising instructor, because I really believe if we want to expand the sport, if we want to you know, gain more investment in the sport, we need to keep talking about it in a way that is accessible for lots of people. And so, you know, I don't just want to kind of make it and then shut down and hide everything away. I still want to very much be trying to create opportunities where I felt I never had them.
I'm just smiling at the thought of somebody going for their Yacht Master practical and meeting Pip Hare on the boat. And just thinking, oh, God, no pressure then. So let's continue with the timeline. You've now completed this race relatively successfully. Did you come out of it thinking, all right, here we go, we're an offshore racer now?
No, I mean, I think if you'd still ask me if I'm a credible offshore racer, I'd probably still go, not sure if I am yet. but it was step one. It was step one. And you know, I think what I realized from that first step is that, you know, it was up to me to then build the pathway to where I wanted to go. And I had to do it in ways that would be achievable. And so there was no way on earth. And it's funny, you know, I sometimes look back through my stuff and I have a sponsorship brochure that I kind of had printed in 2010, just after I'd done the All-Star, basically saying Pip Hare for the Vendée Globe. And it's kind of like, well, why would that ever happen? but I did think, okay, what's the next step? And for me, there were kind of two next steps. One was I needed to prove what I thought could have happened in the Austar with that boat. So that's why we did double-handed round Britain and Ireland. I did that with Phil Stubbs. And that was kind of just, I wanted to prove to myself that we were capable of winning with that boat, because I knew that boat inside out. But then I also understood that boat couldn't go any further. I couldn't race in IRC anymore if I wanted to get to the Vendée. So then the next step was very sadly trading the shed in for the potting shed, which was my knee.
The potting shed was what?
The potting shed was my mini.
Oh, your mini. Okay. Okay. So you finally got to the, you finally succumbed to the lure of the mini fleet. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
So how many years in, how many years in minis?
So I am the only British sailor to have ever completed two mini transats.
Fantastic.
So I did 2011 and 2013. Yeah.
So did you subscribe to the notion that you need to move to France to be a good mini sailor? Did you go and learn French or did you manage to do it from the UK?
No, I actually went all in and I went to France. And, you know, it's, I think it was a really important thing to do because it is so different there, especially in the mini fleet. It's so collaborative. And I did, you know, I was living on a 39 foot racer cruiser, which I sold so I could buy my mini and a van. And I lived in the van and I raced my mini. And, you know, I worked alongside many different nationalities. We all pulled our money so we could get coaches and train. You know, we all shared transport together. But also just the fact that there was a community that was just going out all the time and everyone, you know, there was a massive range of budgets. So the real top sponsored people would, you know, they would have their apartment in town, turn up in their branded van in the morning, go sailing, you know, someone would look after their boat. But there was a massive amount of ragtag people like me who were just kind of making ends meet. Everything we had, we put into our sailing. And you just learn so much with people like that, I think. And it's not just about learning how to make the boat go fast, which I did. I really did. It was also about how important collaboration is, and also about the, you know, resilience and making things work and looking for alternative solutions. And I think one of the things that we struggle with in the UK is we do have this closed image of what a project or a campaign looks like, and it tends to be gold plated, and we tend to look down on things that are not gold plated. Whereas in France, they're just like, the important thing is that we go sailing. It would be great if we could go sailing like that, but we can't. So we're going to go sailing like this. And like that, you get on quicker.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you'd have been brought up in France, whether your access to the racing world might have been quicker than in the UK.
From what I know of France, then yes, definitely. It's, you know, it's definitely a more kind of, well, liberty, equality, fraternity.
Yeah, yeah. even sisterhood.
Yeah.
All right, let's fast forward to your Vendée Globe campaign. I know you didn't pick up the sponsor until quite late in the campaign, but you did manage to build a good team around you. I'm interested in hearing how you managed to do that, how you created that team around you. Really, probably with no budget.
I think a lot of people from the beginning, you know, I've kind of been, you know, for 10 years plodding away in the background, and I've never really been, you know, one of the top sailors doing anything at all. I've always been on the peripheries, but I've always been plodding around. You know, people will go and do this and, oh yeah, Pip's over there and she's plodding along. But because of that, you know, I have met an awful lot of really incredible people who maybe had the same aspirations as me at one time, but it didn't work out, or have been down some of the journey, but not all of it. And, you know, these people, you end up kind of with, you know, a tie to all of them. And I think when I just kind of went, sod it, I am putting everything on the line and I am just going to make this happen. Lots of people just wanted to help because they wanted to see if it was possible. And so from the beginning, I did end up with, you know, good network of friends, volunteers, but also through social media. When we started talking about what I was doing, people I didn't know at all, they, you know, came and helped as well. And that was, you know, incredible. And I remember turning up to the start of the TJV in Le Havre and being opposite Hugo Boss, you know, one of the best funded Imoca campaigns. And I think they had like a full-time crew of 22 or something, all in their matching kit and rucksacks. And I had a shore team of, I think I had something like 17. So I was one of the biggest shore teams there, but they were all volunteers. Fantastic. And like five of them were children. And we just looked like a traveling circus or something. But you know, everyone was there to help and support. And they felt a part of a race like that they might never have felt before, because they were never going to be part of a professional team. So I gave them access to something from the inside that they kind of never would have seen as well. But also, you know, someone who made a massive difference and gave me a credibility was Paul Larson, the world speed sailing record holder. And Paul is a really great friend now, and his partner Helena, but he was a friend of a friend. And I was looking for someone to race in the Fastnet with, and I asked this mutual friend if he would race with me, and he said, no, I can't, but I know someone who will. And he suggested Paul, and I just said, why would he want to sail with me? Why? But actually, you know, Paul started with nothing with Sail Rocket, and he understood my journey, and he understood what it was taking for me to do what I was doing with nothing, to get up every morning with nothing and push it forwards. And so he wanted to help. He wanted to be part of that journey. And so many people did. And I know I'm never going to get that again. I'm never going to have those sorts of interactions again, because actually now we have a sponsor, you know, it's different. People feel differently about it. But that was one of the most incredible things about those 2 years, was that interaction.
Yeah, Paul's been a guest on the podcast, and I've known him for quite a while. When he told me he was working with you, I was initially surprised, and then I thought about it and the way he described it, and I thought, no, this makes absolutely complete sense. I'm sure he added a huge amount of credibility, and also would just be a great sounding board, I would imagine.
Yeah, he actually, you know, he has been then, and he still is now, a great mentor for me, because he's somebody who is never finished. You know, he always thinks that there could be more, it could be better. You know, he's massively curious, but in a really pleasant way. And also, you know, what he also gave me was I constantly question my own validity. I constantly question if I am good enough to be doing what I'm doing, because I never raced with, you know, teams offshore, and because, you know, I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. And so to be able to go racing with somebody like that, and at the end, you know, I said to him, look, I really honestly want you to tell me, am I good enough? And he just said, look, you think in the same way I do. Every time I wanted to suggest something, you were in there already. Or, you know, he said, you got this, you know what you're doing, you are good enough. And I needed that. I needed someone like him to tell me I was not crazy and I was doing the right thing. It made a big difference to me.
So it's a familiar tale to me that certain people come along in the professional sailing, professional sailors' lives kind of at the right moment when they're needed. And it sounds like Paul kind of dropped into your life at the right time.
He really did, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, let's talk then about the Medallia sponsorship. I'm interested to know, before they came along, had you just had a whole bunch of no's and a whole bunch of boardroom meetings that had come to nothing? How did it all work?
I mean, it's the most desperate thing, trying to find sponsorship. It's so hard. And you don't really ever know what anybody wants. You don't, you know, and you create this wonderful singing, dancing deck that nobody reads. And I went to a meeting in London once where, you know, we turned up, we had no money at all, absolutely no money. And the appointment was changed in the morning, like 2 hours before. And I had to buy a premium time new rail ticket with the last £100 I had in my account to go up for this meeting, and turned up and the guy kind of wasn't really that interested and sat drinking a milkshake through the whole thing, and it was just like we were the lunchtime entertainment, and that was, you know, to me that was the last £100 in my account, and it is just so soul destroying. And actually, when before Medallia came in, I kind of thought all the time through 2019, every single time I thought, this is it, I've hit rock bottom, I can't go any further, I just can't go any further. I had so much debt, you know, I couldn't borrow any more money. But all the time, either a personal donor would come in and pay that entry fee or cover those costs, or I had a crowdfund that people were just donating into, just blew me away. But then of course we got to COVID, we got to lockdown, and I had been talking to this one sponsor who had committed to putting enough money to get me out of refit, and the conversations just went dead, you know, everything went dead. And weirdly, in lockdown, I was less stressed than any other time, because I understood then that this was completely out of my control. All the rest of the time, you know, I was always thinking, there must be something I can do. There must be something I can do. And then lockdown happened and it was like, okay, there is absolutely nothing I can do. But what I did see was an opportunity, because all of these other sporting events were being cancelled and postponed. The Olympics was postponed. The World Cup was postponed. But the Vendée Globe was going ahead. And I just thought, okay, this has to be an opportunity. But I mean, I hit rock bottom. I was days away from bankruptcy. And I was Googling what happens when you go bankrupt, because I had no idea. And I reached out to Sport England actually as well, and I wrote to them and just said, look, you know, all of these sporting events are not happening. We have a chance that this one is going to happen. I've got myself this far. Is there anything at all you can do? But you know, no one can. There's none of those grants or anything are set up to help someone like me. And then out of the blue, I received a one-line email from the CEO of Medallia. Just said, are there still sponsorship opportunities available? And I couldn't, you know, I just thought, wow, I've been banging my head against the wall for 2.5 years and someone's emailing me. And then I just thought, okay, no, this is just someone messing me around.
Yeah.
And I Googled him. I was like, okay, he says that's, you know, it all tallies up. And so I sent him a one-line email back and said, yes, but we need to have a phone call. And we had a Zoom meeting. And during the Zoom meeting, he'd basically read, they'd had to shut down all of their traveling, their conferences and all that sort of thing. So they had surplus budget. They had a lot of clients who were doing the Vendée as well. He knew about the Vendée. He'd read about me and my story and the fact that I was saying, look, this is still an opportunity. And within 2 weeks of him dropping that one-line email on me, I had a title sponsor.
Fantastic.
How did that happen?
Fantastic. And then everything changed. Your whole perspective changes.
Yeah, it does. But I think, you know, the one thing that was really important about that, and this is still kind of how I operate, is that I had a really, really clear vision about what good looked like. know, when it wasn't dreaming, I had planned it. You know, I knew exactly if I got money, I knew what I would spend it on, including, you know, number one was Geoff Brown. You know, I'd already said to him, if I get money, I want you to run my campaign, to run the technical side. So, you know, I'd kind of lined everything up. And I think there could have been a moment where that contract was signed, that money was dropped on me, and it still wouldn't have happened because we were so close to the start of the race. You could make some appalling decisions. You know, you could spend money, but also, you know, I hate to say it, but people can also really take advantage of that too. You know, if I hadn't have had this really, you know, this really involved plan about what I wanted to do, anybody could have come in and said, spend it on this, spend it on that, spend it on the other. But because I'd been just thinking and planning for so long, the minute that money came in, I knew how to activate it all, and off we went. But I mean, it was just whirlwind, absolute whirlwind.
Well, you regularly hear that the, you know, getting to the start line of the Vendée is as tough as completing the race. Did it feel like that when you finally set off, when the support crew jumped into the rib and you were on your own?
It did. I mean, I was exhausted. I was so tired, and in really mentally, physically, I was in poor shape when I started that race. And also it had been, you know, in a massive emotional disappointment because we were in lockdown, and I, you know, I walked down the dock to that boat on my own. None of my friends, I had a small group of friends there, but my family weren't there. You know, the people that I imagined sharing that moment with were not there. And that was really, really hard. And then I kind of got out to the start and I was looking around me, and I think it would have been really easy to look at everyone and everything that they'd had and that the experiences they'd had and what they'd got, and be kind of feel like an underdog and be jealous almost, or, you know, but actually I just thought, okay, we've made it, this has happened, and now I am going to drink this up, because flipping heck, I've been trying for 30 years to get here, and it better be good.
did you give 18-year-old Pip a little nod back down the years and say, look, I'm here, I've done it?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think about it quite often, because I still don't really know what made me believe that I could do it, but I knew at 17, I knew, and I had no reason to believe I could do that. I had no exposure to anything like that, but I was just like, yeah, I was right.
Now, you took us all on an amazing adventure, and as I said at the beginning of the podcast, I feel like I lived that race with you. But now with the benefit of a bit of hindsight and a bit of perspective, I'm sure there were huge highs and lows for you, and we saw some of them, but can you remember what the biggest high and the lowest low was during that race for you?
I mean, the biggest high was the Southern Ocean, just the first half of the Southern Ocean, because that's kind of where I really, really started to put my foot down and overtake people. And, you know, when I was 15th, I was ahead of 7 foiling boats, and I'd overtaken Alan, who had Super Bigu before me in the previous race, and he'd come back in a newer boat with foils. And at one, and I overtook Callie as well at one point on his, like, I think it was his 5th Vendée, and I'd overtaken him in with foils, and I got into such a rhythm, and I'd kind of figured it out. I'd figured out what I had to do to get past these guys. And I knew I was pushing that boat harder than it had ever been pushed before. And I loved that experience, and I loved walking that knife edge and then seeing the results. And that for me is my enduring memory of being down there, was just that, yes. and just kind of, you know, and I'd be watching them all the time and just thinking, okay, well, I'm just going to go a little bit further south, and then foot to the floor, and it's like, yes, they can't get me now. It's so good. And then, of course, I broke my rudder. But I don't think that, although breaking, I don't think breaking my rudder was such a massive event for me as kind of it was for everyone else watching it.
It was for us.
Because it just, I mean, it's kind of like going back to that breaking of that shroud, you know, the lower. It happened. And that's it. It's just happened. So what are you going to do? You are going to fix it. And I was devastated because I was ahead of Alan and Callie. I wasn't devastated because I was frightened, and I wasn't devastated because I didn't think I could repair it. I was just devastated because I didn't want to throw my 15th place away.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, it was a really intense period. It led to an awful lot of other problems, which kind of never, I guess, got addressed or seen. And I'm super proud that I did that repair as quickly as I did. But that wasn't the lowest moment for me. The lowest moment for me was actually when I got ill coming back up the Atlantic, because I guess I was massively run down. I'd lost a huge amount of weight. I got this terrible allergic reaction, and I was really, really ill. We were struggling to manage it remotely, and I just kept getting overtaken, and I was so disappointed with my body for letting me down. And I never thought it was going to be me that let me. I always thought it would be the boat and then I would fix it, but it was my body and I couldn't fix it. And that those were the most difficult times. Those were really, there was one day in particular where I was just so unbelievably miserable. And I couldn't do anything. My skin was in these huge blisters. I couldn't touch anything. I couldn't do anything. That every single time the boat moved, it was causing me pain. I was in mental pain because I could see Stefan coming up behind me, and Didac was behind him, and I just thought, you know, all the time I'd relied on my resilience and my ability to say, yes, I can change this, I can make this different. And I just kind of thought, I can't do anything about this. All I'm doing is counting the hours and the minutes until I get better, and I can't change this. And that was really difficult to deal with.
And that, did that problem resolve itself eventually? It just took time?
Yeah, I was ill for about 4 weeks. Wow. I had I was on a lot of different medication. It was very challenging for my team ashore and for the race doctor, and you know, and I did eventually get better. It got massively alleviated by getting into the cooler weather as well. But yeah, I think I probably started to get better about 1 week before the finish was when I started to get better. Yeah.
Sounds horrific. Sounds absolutely horrific. Now, I keep talking about it. You carried this wave of fans around the world. I think you kind of created a whole audience for yourself from probably people who might not have known who you were when you started the race, but certainly were carried along with the adventure of it all. I mean, you are a great communicator on the boat. Your personality is such that people like you when they see you interviewed. But I was interested to know, was it a deliberate strategy to communicate that well and to try and garner this audience, or did it just happen?
No, it was a deliberate strategy in the fact that, you know, we went into the race knowing there was no way on earth we could win the race. And so, you know, we said, well, what is the objective then? And I said, okay, I want to tell the best story in the British, in the English language. And I think, you know, I knew that maybe I told the story in a slightly different way. And that goes again, you know, back to the beginning, back to me trying to share my my sailing stories with a bunch of friends who had no idea what I was doing. And I think, you know, I struggled for so long to find sponsorship for a minority sport. People don't really understand sailing. They think it's closed up, you know, it's inaccessible. There's a language people don't understand. There are so many barriers. But at the end of the day, the Vendée Globe is, I think, one of the most challenging sporting events on the planet. And actually, the technical side of it is a small side of what we do. And everything else, what we're asking what we're asking human beings to do for an extended period of time with sleep deprivation and the problem solving and the actual physical effort of it, but the mental strength and the resilience, and that is about being a human being, and everyone can relate to that. So that's the story that I really tried to tell. Obviously, I was blending it with the sailing, but also we just had, I did think quite hard before I made each of my video clips. You know, some of them were off the cuff, but other ways I was trying to create a picture that would show, give people an opportunity to see into my world, not just look at my face talking about how hard it was and how tired I was, but, you know, with our big selfie stick, you know, trying to, this is what it looks like. This is what power looks like, you know, and it, that was quite fun actually doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. Well, I mean, you certainly did it extremely well. And as I say, you created this whole audience. Your sponsor must have been delighted with that aspect of it.
They were. And, you know, I don't think nobody, I mean, we benefited enormously from the fact that everyone was stuck at home and there was nothing else to do than watch us.
That was the irony, was that, you know, the Vendée's about you guys being cooped up on a boat on your own, whereas we were the ones that were cooped up and you looked like you had all the freedom in the world.
Well, we did. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think we did benefit from an exposure, that the kind of exposure that the Vendée's never had before. But I was genuinely shocked by the amount of people that had engaged with my race and what I was doing. And I really didn't actually appreciate it until kind of a couple of weeks after I'd finished, because I didn't know. And I kind of said to the team, I don't really want to know either. So it was a bit of a shock to me.
My favorite moment for you in the whole race was on Andy Robertson's daily TV show, when your sponsor CEO spoke to you live and said, "All right, Pitt, let's go shopping for another boat for the next race." That was just such a brilliant piece of, you could call it PR, but it was a great piece of TV. You must be able to remember that pretty well.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and he was a man of his word as well. And I got off the boat, walked up the pontoon, did all my media stuff, and then danced with Jean Le Cam on the table for a bit. And then
name dropper.
And then I had a Zoom call with Leslie Stretch, CEO of Medallia, and he said, "Okay, what do you want to do?" And I was like, "I want to do another one." And he said, "Okay, well, look, this all feels great, but go and cool your heels for a couple of weeks and then call me back." And I got to 5 days and I just had to call him again. I said, "Okay, I want to do it again." It's like, "It's not 2 weeks." "I know, but I want to do it again. And we need to buy a boat really soon."
Yeah.
So it all happened quite quickly, yeah.
And the boat that you've bought is Bure Valet, which finished third last time around. So much more modern boat, but you didn't go all the way to the kind of latest designs. And no. I read that you've thought maybe the latest designs will be too extreme, too much of a jump.
Yeah, I had thought about it, the what if, before I left, because you always need to be thinking about what the next step looks like. And I looked at the 2020 gen boats and you know, nobody really knew how they were going to perform in the Southern Ocean, because, you know, nobody had any, because of lockdown and stuff, there wasn't really much kind of examples of you know, what they'd done. But also they just looked too different, too much of a big step for me. But the 2016 boats, I went and had a look around Maitre Coq, and I just kind of thought, yeah, I get this, I understand this. And, but actually, you know, that was my gut feeling. But if you apply, you know, a more sensible logic to it, then we bought a boat that was incredible, you know, it holds the course record. It came third in this race, and actually Louis, you know, he was out for a number of days repairing his main track. So, you know, it had the potential to be first. It's an incredibly well-built boat. Originally, there was a big budget put into it, so it's very well-built. And also, we can put bigger foils on it. And the interesting thing is that, you know, I think we might see in the 2024 gen boats, they went narrower for 2020, big foils, narrower boats, they're going wider again. Yeah. And our boat is max beam on the rules. So I think it was a good buy.
Because it was Banque Populaire originally for Armel de Cléache. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it holds the course record.
So I know you know what it's like to sail, so I'm going to ask you about it. The reason I know is my spies tell me you were out on the Western approaches to the British Isles at the end of last year, finding out what your new baby could do. So tell us the story. What's she like?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't even seen a half of what that boat can do yet, but it is incredible. It's much easier to sail than I thought it was going to be. Yeah, I think the big difference with this boat is ergonomically, it's much easier for me. I'm undercover, I'm dry. That's a big difference. I mean, that's a world of difference. But also the boat's better set up. It's easier to manage. The systems are all really similar. But what's interesting is that you can get the boat up to kind of 85% polars quite quickly and quite easily. And that is fast. You know, you're doing 20 knots before you've even thought about it. But I think, you know, to get up to the 95-100% polars, that's where I'm going to have to work. That's where I'm going to have to improve my knowledge. That's where I need to work with coaches, because just trying to maintain that constant level of performance is going to take more knowledge than I currently have, I think.
So that's what you mean in the quote. We've got the Vendée Globe 2024 firmly in our sights. This time we're going to be faster, fitter, and more determined than ever. So that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm more determined. I think I'm a pretty determined person. I don't know what more determined looks like, but yeah, the rest of it we're working on.
Absolutely. Well, listen, just to close things off, just talk us through now. I saw a press release earlier this week that said the race was 1,000 days away, so it's less than 1,000 days now.
Yeah.
What are the kind of milestone moments for you? What's the schedule, and what races might we see you do in the boat?
So this year is going to be our biggest year for racing, and we're kind of racing with the boat with the small foils in its current configuration. So really, it's a big learning year for me, but it's also my qualification year for the Vendée, because we still need to qualify. So I am launching the boat in a couple of weeks, and then going to Portugal for early season training. And my first race is the Bermude Mille, which is from Douarnenez to the Fastnet to Finisterre and back, and that's solo. It's a qualification race. Then it's the Vendée Arctique, which is solo from Les Sables d'Olonne, 3,500 miles around the top of Iceland. I don't know why we're going north. It seems crazy. and then back. And then I'm doing Round Britain and Ireland in the summer, because it's a great race, fabulous race. It's not part of the Amoka circuit, but it's a great British race, and I want to support our British offshore racing scene. And then it's the Route de Rome at the end of the year. So that's 2022. And then 2023, we are upgrading our foils. So we're getting bigger foils, which will take about 6 months to fit and adapt the boat. So we'll do a TJV, hopefully Fastnet, and then TJV at the end of 2023. And then in 2024, there are two solo transatlantics to the US and back. And then it's the Vendée.
Fantastic. It's such an exciting scene now for the Imokas, and throw the ocean race in there as well. And there's some great offshore sailing to watch over the next few years. Are you fully funded right now, Pip, or is there still room for any sponsors who are listening to get their foot in the door?
Still definitely room for sponsors. We've got a lovely jib that has no branding on at all. And yeah, so we have, you know, the level of funding that we have has kind of guaranteed that we will be taking place in the Vendée. And actually, we're still looking for sponsorship that will just be that performance. You know, the extra budget will make a difference to our performance.
I have to just ask you one question. You said you still need to qualify. Do you not qualify automatically from doing the last race?
No, every single other year then you have, but this year they've scrapped it. You have to start from scratch again this year. So, there are 40 places available at the moment. There are 52 teams interested. So, got to finish races.
You certainly do have to finish races.
Yeah.
Well, Pip, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you today. I wish you the very best of luck with the campaign, with all of those races that you've talked about. Hopefully, we can catch up with you again before the start of the Vendée, maybe even more than once, and just get an update on your progress. But for now, Pip, thanks so much for talking to me. I really, really do appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Pip Hare for such an open and honest interview. And thanks also to all of you for listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. But until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.